Welcome, and thank you for holding. At this time, your lines are in a listen-only mode. A public comment period is scheduled to take place after the opening remarks. If you are interested in commenting on today's topic, you may press star 1 on your phone at any time to be placed into the queue. There is a limited time set aside for public comment, so please keep your comment brief. Stating your name and affiliation when prompted is optional. However, please provide at least an identifying alias. This will assist in administrating the session. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to turn the call over to Odette Madriago. Ma'am, you may begin.
Welcome, everybody, for our second phone call to discuss tiered alternative assessment options. This has been, I think, one of the more challenging subjects. We've gotten some new ideas generated. And a little bit later, after Jeff does opening remarks, I want to kind of open the conversation with some observations about some discussions that Corey and Jeff and I had following the first phone call that will kind of, I hope, set some direction for the phone call today. Again, I appreciate all of you taking your time, especially as we're getting closer to the summer vacation time, to work with us on this, both in terms of participating in the phone calls and preparing the written homework. This is going to make this, I think, a very successful effort, and I do want to tell you we're starting to merge a little bit with the discussion that Subcommittee 1 is having, but I think we all expected that would happen. And we will merge even more as we get to the full GRASP meeting in July. So welcome aboard, and I'm going to turn it over to Radhika to do roll call.
Hey, good morning, everybody. I'm going to do a quick roll call. We'll go around the room here first.
Patrick?
Amelia Rodriguez.
Colleen Jack.
Corey, yes.
Jeff Wong. Odette Madriago.
And now I'll turn it over to the phone. Kelly Moran.
Kelly.
Bruce Cord.
Thank you, Bruce. Ann Wallen.
Ann Wallen and Horgan.
Thank you. Richard Dennison.
I'm here.
Good morning,
in D.C.
And as of my understanding, Meg Schwartzman is going to be a little bit late, and Richard Leroff and Mike Kushner, they're not participating in the call. Okay, let's begin. So I'm going to hand it over to Jeff.
Good morning, everyone. I thank you again for participating. Other members of the GRASP that are online, I thank you for coming in, members of the public. Again, I wonder that this is an open meeting and it's on the record. Again, I have the great task of serving as your stand-in co-chair. And again, as I've said before, I hope to be methodical and keep to a time schedule in terms of having this meeting and getting some input. Again, this will be a working session. The intent is to get toward some input, good input that we can be discussed, presented, and presented before the July 14th, 15th physical meeting here at the Cal EPA headquarters. Sacramento. This is a reminder, as last time, I'm only here to facilitate the discussion, and Odette and the staff will actually respond to any questions that you might have. So again, the topic today, as was before, is the tiering of the AA and how to get at that. And with that, I'll stop and turn the mic over to Odette. She has a few observations.
Thank you, Jeff.
Odette?
Yes.
This is Kelly. Before you proceed, my ability to hear the call is being interfered with. I think someone has near their microphone either a notebook or books or something like that that they're moving around, and it causes you guys to cut in and out. And I don't know if it's in your room or one of the other callers.
Okay. I'm not sure it's us. We've been fairly quiet in here, but we will be extra careful, and I ask everyone else that's on the phone that does not have a muted line to be careful as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kelly, for letting us know. So when Jeff and Corey and I met to discuss this topic in more detail and try to get a better grasp of the issues and the decision points ourselves, several things really came to light for us that we focused in on. One of them was the concept of what is meant by life cycle assessment tool as it's used in our governing statute. I think some people, when they hear that term, they think that we're talking about some kind of complex mathematical model. But in the context of our statute, I think we have the flexibility to view it as something more robust than that, or less robust than that. It could be something more qualitative. And one of the things that leads me to that conclusion is that the statute requires the department in adopting these regulations to identify or develop life cycle assessment tools that provide for ease of use and transparency for use by manufacturers and the general public, including consumers, when making purchasing decisions. So when I look at those words, I'm not sure that in every case that mathematical models are going to meet those criteria. So I think we need to expand the horizons of our thinking in terms of life cycle assessment tools to look at, to go beyond just mathematical models. So that's one point I wanted to make. The other point I wanted to make that is particular to this subgroup in terms of tiering, there actually, I think, are three concepts that kind of jumped out for us, two of which I think were captured in the original paper we sent out, one of which I think is not. So the three concepts would be in terms of the level of robustness of the review. And this is something that was dealt with in one of the attachments that we sent out and was actually prepared by last year by Kelly Moran and Blake and Ken Geiser. The second way that you could think about tiering is the number of factors that are evaluated, A through M, that are listed in the statute, which I know you've discussed. And the third way that could be conceived is the number of life cycle segments that are looked at when comparing alternatives. In other words, would there be situations where you would advise that we not necessarily do a evaluation for all of the life cycle segments? And finally, I think that you all might come up with something very creative where maybe you suggest a mix of these three different concepts. And it's also conceivable, and I think you perhaps have touched on this, and I think Subcommittee 1 touched on it a little bit, that we use some or all of these types of considerations through some kind of a screening approach. And some of the handouts that we posted and emailed last week kind of delve into some of these thoughts. So with that, I'm going to just turn the discussion back over to Jeff, and the staff and I are here to answer any questions you may have and provide any clarification that we may be able to provide. So, Jeff?
Thank you. Thank you, Odette. So that gives us an idea for further thinking. And it sounds like I'm looking at our schedule. It's about 9:40 our time. Public comment is scheduled for 9:50 to 10:10. Just as a part of agenda review, I have set aside from 10:10 to 10:30 sort of an opening discussion or clarifying questions or any comments that folks want to make. My hope then is from 10:30 to 10:45, more comments related to question 2A, which we had laid out before. From 10:45 to 11, spend that time talking about question 2B. We'll have a 5-minute break at 11 o'clock, which I know will go to, will expand to 15 minutes, just because we all can't read time. Odette is shaking her head. So approximately 11:05 to somewhere around 11:15, we'll try to start up again. And clearly at 11:15 to 11:30, hopefully we can discuss question 2C. At 11:30 to 11:45, we can talk about the remaining questions. And then from 11:45 to 11:55, have some sort of wrap-up discussion and assignment of homework and the like. So that's the crude plan that I have, and I will attempt to stick to it. but I understand that we may need some flexibility as we deal with certain issues. So with that, I'm foregoing ahead with public comment. Here at this location, I guess I should, 9:50 to 10:10, but we can go ahead with public comment. So maybe I will ask the operator, how are we with the number of people in the queue?
At this time, I show there are no comments in the queue. At this time, if you would like to provide comments to the Green Ribbon Science Panel Subcommittee members on today's topic, please press star 1 and ensure your line is not muted. You'll be prompted to record your name. Stating your name and affiliation is optional. However, providing us at least an identifying alias will assist us in managing the session. Again, pressing star 1 will enable you to join the queue and make a comment. If you wish to be removed from the queue, press star 2. One moment while we wait for our first comment.
Okay, so as we wait for people to queue up, let's go to the physical locations to see if there's anybody present at the physical locations.
Currently, there's nobody with DPSC here. Is there any member of the public in any of the physical locations that we have on our public notice?
Nobody in Berkeley.
Thank you.
Nobody in St. Paul.
Thank you so much.
No one in Oregon.
Okay.
No one in D.C.
All right.
But we'd all like in Horgan, right?
Yeah.
Are others hearing that clicking sound in the background? This is Richard. I'm hearing a clicking that's every twice a second or so. No?
The keyboard? Is it typing?
No, it's an electronic clicking, and it's causing the audio to cut in and out.
We're not experiencing that here in Sacramento.
Richard, can you...
Does
it sound like a clock?
Sort of, yes. A little more electronic than that, but...
And you're still experiencing it, Richard?
I am. Maybe I should hang up and call back in.
Well, if nobody else is experiencing, yes, I would recommend you do that. And,
okay.
We can wait till you get back on before we proceed.
Okay, I'll be right back.
All right.
Is there anybody in the line for public comment?
I show there are no comments in the queue at this time.
Okay, so we're going to wait for Richard to join back, and after that we can proceed our conference further, please. So please announce when he joins back.
I sure will. Excuse me, Mr. Dennison has rejoined.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm back. Thanks.
Welcome back, Richard. Okay, so we have some space in our agenda, and there is no public comment either at the physical locations nor on the teleconference, so we'll move ahead. So I think what we should do is first note that both Meg and Richard turned in some comments. We have prior comments from Kelly, which she worked on with Ann and Ken. So I guess the first thing we should do is, does anybody have any opening observations or response to Odette's opening comments. The next thing I'd like to do after that is maybe explain the diagram that we passed out, plus I'd like to have Richard, and I guess Meg's not there, so Richard sort of maybe go through a little bit of his general comments that he's turned in. Does that sound fair? So with that, any opening comments, response to Odette's remarks?
This is Kelly. I'd like to get in the queue for that.
All right. Kelly, you're first.
Okay. I just wanted to say three things. First, I think that the interpretation of LCA tool that Odette presented makes a lot of sense, and I've read the statute the same way that you all did and had been thinking along the lines that that simple tools could include things like a questionnaire or other ways of walking people through the process of doing the thinking that then drew out the responses on each of the issues. So I just want to say that my thinking is very consistent with yours, and that's probably why you saw that in the input that Ken and Ann and I provided earlier. The second thing I wanted to say is that I think in terms of the tiering options, we last time, I actually would hope that, Jeff, when you get us to the questions again, that we could maybe reframe those in terms of these options. I think that you heard pretty strongly from the subcommittee last time that the number of factors evaluated was kind of a non-starter, so maybe it would be better for us to spend our time talking about life cycle assessments as an option. And I think we've already kind of talked about level of robustness and seem to have pretty good consensus on that. But I guess we could ask if everyone else does. And then the third thing I want to mention is that I think an important factor in considering the tiering is to consider the cost to actually do the assessment, the alternatives assessment, life cycle thinking, that document, and that we're probably not quite ready for it at this point, but there should be some examination given to how some of the things that we're talking about affect the cost of doing the document, because I don't think that there's an interest in the state in having the cost be unreasonable, particularly for an initial assessment. We recognize that there might be need for follow-up work in specific areas, but I think we want to think through how that approach would work, keeping the idea of cost in mind. And I talked with Mike Kirshner, who's not on the call today, after the last call about this issue, and it's something that he and I both felt fairly strongly needed to be part of the equation as the process proceeds, and that folks like Mike, who actually do life cycle assessments for businesses, are good folks to talk to get some sort of feel for which things cost more or less, and he and I even had some discussion about orders of magnitude of cost for various kinds of things. And I'm not sure we're really quite ready to have that discussion today, but I did want to put it out there that that's something that's in my mind and was in Mike's mind in case other folks are also thinking about that. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So, Kelly, on your item number two, remind me that that's an issue you want to bring up. I have all these little pieces of paper in front of me. As I try to keep everything straight, a few things might slip by.
Absolutely. Jeff, I think you do quite well. Thank you.
Okay. So any other comments?
Jeff, this is Richard.
Sure.
I wanted to add something to Odette's delineation of the ways in which alternative assessments might be tiered to suggest that a fourth dimension of caring could entail what range of alternatives are considered in the alternatives assessment. And this is picking up on an idea that was, I guess, floated last year and then briefly mentioned on our last call, that would entail a tiered approach to determining which alternatives warrant further analysis, that would start with, at least in one formulation that I put in my homework assignment, would start with asking which alternatives among the available ones are better, resolve the concern that led the chemical of concern to be identified as such, and limit further alternatives assessment only to those alternatives that resolved or significantly improved on that parameter. So it's another way of thinking about tiering that comes from the range of alternative side rather than the depth of or scope of analysis side. Is that clear? Does that make sense?
Yes, it is, and thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. Is that it?
It is, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? All right, hearing none. I just want to briefly describe the graphic that we passed out in. I actually have to ask because I haven't been here. Did we pass out the other graphic that Corey developed? Both of these have been passed out. Okay.
Posted,
But posted. Okay, so Kelly had asked a question of us earlier, you know, what were the sites or the sources of these graphics? And I know that Odette provided a response. So just to be clear so all of you can understand, the graphics were, the one is a PowerPoint and the other one is a PDF. They're just simply constructs for discussion, sort of to have people look at sort of a line of thought and to organize questions in terms of tiering. And the longer one, the more complicated one, is simply trying to take pieces of input that we had from the director, from Professor Malloy and Julia Quinn, and integrating them with a few of the discussion items that we had heard, and then trying to put it together with life cycle assessment. It is not designed to be a blueprint of AA. These are merely constructs by which to organize discussion. So they're just some ways that we try to put our thoughts down in graphical form. So they're not designed to compete with the previous graphics that we had of the regulation, nor are they designed to compete with the graphic that Kelly, Ken, and Ann developed. So again, they're simply discussion items. Actually, if any of you are a participant in Professor Malloy's work, he actually has another kind of graphic that describes a heating process related to alternatives assessment. So with that, I just want to provide that explanation. Any questions about that?
What was the PowerPoint slide that you talk about? I'm not sure that I received that.
Okay, it says at the top of it, it says Topic 1, AB 879, Alternatives Assessment, and has a date of June 6, 2011. And it was really designed for Subgroup 1, but when Subgroup 1 talks, they like to talk about tiering, and, of course, Subgroup 2 likes to talk about tiering, but they also like to talk about the infrastructure of an AA, so they're very much useful in both contexts.
I'm afraid I don't have that. I'm sorry. I don't know when or where it would have come.
It's posted under Subcommittee 1 if you have access to the Internet.
I'll see if I can arrange that. Thanks. I won't delay things looking for it.
Yeah. It's just to help you organize your thoughts. But it was really designed to help us organize our thoughts. But yeah. All right. With that, let's move on. I remember what I said from before. Both Meg and Richard provided some handouts in terms of responding to the homework assignment, and maybe I'd like to offer the opportunity to Richard to go over his responses that he had. And the paper is dated 6/13/11. So if you would like, the floor is yours, Dr. Dennison.
Thank you, Jeff, or Dr. Wong. I started with just laying out what I think at least one of the aims of a tiered approach to alternatives assessment would be. And that would be to relatively quickly inform a decision as to how relevant and significant the availability of alternatives is to deciding whether and if so how to regulate a chemical that's been identified as being of concern and then a product of concern. So I'm kind of viewing the concept of tiering through that lens. How do we get to a point where we know enough to be able to know whether alternatives availability is relevant and significant? And then where it would be found to be relevant and significant, it could be a means to focus, I guess, in Kelly and Ken and Ann's terminology, pursue a focused follow-up assessment review that would zero in on the most important elements. And where it is either not deemed to be relevant or needed, or is not relevant to make initial decisions about regulatory responses, it would allow DTSC to move to those expeditiously, even if a decision were made to pursue a more focused follow-up. So I guess the gist of the other comments here is to suggest some ways in which we could approach streamlining. Most of these did come up in the last call, so I'm not going to belabor them, but I think influencing or having some control over the robustness of the assessment, I think, is important, and I talked about a couple of principles that could be applied to help to bound that borrowed from life cycle and alternatives assessment frameworks that others have proposed. and I then suggest that kind of the desired approach that I would want to see here is that you initially do an alternatives assessment that does entail some examination of all the required factors, and that the outcome of each of those factor assessments would be a decision as to whether or not that factor is a significant contributor to the impact of a given alternative that's among those being compared, and would be a significant differential among those alternatives. So if you have a significant factor, but all of the alternatives share it to a very similar degree, then it may not be worth doing a lot more on that factor. So the outcome of that alternatives assessment would be a consideration of all the factors and a justification as to whether or not that factor is worth pursuing further based on its contribution to the impact and its differential contribution across the alternatives. Under the header question 2A, I sort of elaborate on that a little bit more with this notion that one would have an initial alternatives assessment, a determination about regulatory response, and then a more in-depth focused assessment that would follow that, so that it would provide an opportunity to get for DTSC to get to regulatory responses that are not dependent on the availability of alternatives in an expeditious manner, even if there might be other regulatory responses that would be informed by a more in-depth focused assessment that could happen sequentially. I already mentioned this idea of taking a tiered approach to determining what alternatives are assessed, and arguing that a reference point there could be look at alternatives only those alternatives that fix the problem that led to the chemical of concern being identified in the first place. And then a concept that I think came up at the end of our call last time was that there would be advantage to including among the alternatives being looked at the alternative of essentially foregoing use of the chemical in the product of concern, that that ought to be one of the alternatives being compared. And it is a way of getting at and testing the hypothesis as to whether that chemical is essential in that use in a manner that would allow and inform DTSC to conceivably be able to place some restriction on that use without necessarily having to worry as much about whether there's an alternative available. under question 2D, I did suggest a little bit of a rewording there. I know there's some concern about this question of whether we're really talking about tiers of alternative assessment or we're talking about an initial alternatives assessment and then a more focused assessment as a follow-up. So that might require some retweaking of that wording there. For example, what should be the circumstances or conditions for requiring a manufacturer to conduct a focused follow-up assessment review might be a better way to word that question. But again, this kind of sequential approach that would allow DTSC the ability to make initial regulatory responses that might be followed up with once more information is available with additional regulatory responses later that are dependent on the outcome of that focused assessment. So that's it.
Thank you, Richard. So any comments from the committee on Richard's responses?
Yeah, this is Bruce. I would agree, especially Richard's comment about identifying alternatives that are significantly better than the chemical concern with respect to the parameters that led it to be identified in the first place. I guess one of the questions I have is, as a, let's say a manufacturer identifies an alternative and goes through this assessment again and has to compare it against the chemical of concern, we don't have the issue where the committee might come back and say, well, we don't like that alternative because it uses too much energy and water. Please come up with a better one. Isn't just one alternative that's better than the chemical of concern all that's required of the manufacturer?
The statute isn't really specific to that. The statute just says that we will adopt regulations governing setting forth an alternatives assessment process. So, you know, whether the regs will ultimately say that, I don't know at this point. And if that's a discussion you all want to have, it would be kind of a side discussion to what we're discussing, but you could have that discussion.
I guess that my question, I mean, as I look at the A through M factors, in many cases, we won't even have all that information on the chemical of concern, right? So you're already going to have to generate all of that data for the chemical of concern in order to compare it to the alternative number one, are you not?
If you're looking at all of those factors. Now, remember, you know, one of the things we've talked about in terms of Tier AA, you're talking about generating data. Is there a way to do a more qualitative comparison of two or more alternatives for some of those factors? And that's a question I'm tossing out to all of you.
This is Kelly, and I think that we do, Odette, one of the things that I hope you'll put on your list is, and I'm sure you probably already got it there actually, we'll be figuring out what is a reasonable range of alternatives for alternatives assessment And I don't really think it's probably what your desire for us to spend our time on this call talking about that. But I am inclined towards Richard's idea that there might be a tiering approach that would involve first just solving the problem that's associated with the chemical of concern. And this is sort of equivalent to something we've talked about before, is there an easy fix? So looking at a narrower range of alternatives when there's something that's good and obvious and can just solve that problem. And if that doesn't come out with a great alternative, then broadening the range to include a broader array of alternatives. So that's something I guess I would just put out there as I think that Richard's heading somewhere, but I can tell that you all probably need to do some thinking about, well, what is that definition of reasonable range of alternatives and how that would fit in.
I think this is Richard. To Bruce's point about data availability, I wonder, Odette, my reading of the statute indicates or would suggest that these are factors that need to be taken into consideration. It doesn't necessarily raise the question of if there are insufficient information, do you need to generate additional information in order to meet the test of having taken it into consideration. And I think that's kind of ambiguous at best in the statute. It's kind of silent on that question. Is that a fair reading?
We would agree, yes.
And then I think the other thing that I would just say about the role of alternatives assessment in the overall framework of the law is there's sort of two ways to think about it. And again, I think the statute is kind of silent on this. One is that somehow the intent was to have the regulatory response be dictated by the outcome of the alternatives assessment. But the other is that the intent was that the regulatory response be informed by, as opposed to dictated by, the outcome of the alternatives assessment. And those are somewhat different in terms of what would be required in terms of the robustness of the alternatives assessment, its scope, et cetera, I would think. So my own inclination is to believe that it's closer to the alternatives assessment being something that informs regulatory responses and therefore the statute calls on the alternatives assessment to take into consideration a range of factors.
Colleen, I think I would phrase it this way. At a minimum, the alternatives assessment informs the regulatory response. The fact that the range of regulatory responses is open-ended, the statute expressly says, including but not limited to, I suppose it implies that there could be some overarching factor not listed in the A to M factors that could somehow tip the balance of the regulatory response selected beyond those items addressed in the alternative assessment. I can't say what that might be or that that's a very likely scenario, but I think I would agree with you at a minimum, or I would rephrase it, at a minimum, the alternatives assessment is intended to inform the selection of the regulatory response or responses.
And can I just follow up on that? because some of the regulatory responses don't have even an implicit tie to the alternatives assessment or the outcome of it, that to me also argues that the alternatives assessment would be one input into, but not necessarily the determinant of, the regulatory response taken.
Well, you know, if things don't work out for you in your current career, you could pursue the practice of law, because I think that's an excellent analysis of legislative intent. If you can make the argument, and I'm not saying I've looked at it this way, but I think you're onto something, that the regulatory responses don't tie neatly or link closely or logically to specific factors in the A to M factors in the alternative assessment, that does lend support to your notion that there are other things that we're supposed to be thinking about in selecting the regulatory response. We'll have to ponder that some more.
That's good, because it's probably a little late for me to think about a career change.
Okay. All right. So, Richard, and maybe for Kelly and Bruce, I'm trying to understand something, Richard, is that you, in your view, you're looking at elements A through M as all equivalent drivers in alternatives assessment. And your approach to tiering is to say, let's make the initial problem or the initial chemical of concern the driver and sort of allow the other sets of the elements to become either informative factors or balancing factors among alternatives that address the initial problem. Do I have that right?
I think that that's an interesting way to look at it. And I think from one angle, yes, that's what I'm saying, that what identifies something as a chemical of concern would be the initial filter that you would look at alternatives through, and only those that fix that problem would then go on to be subject to the alternatives assessment, which would have to consider all of the factors A to M in comparing them.
So,
but it would be a way to simplify the analysis and make sure that you're fixing the problem that got you into this process in the first place.
Okay, so and what we're trying, what your proposal is trying to avoid is we have, let's say, an initial product which has lead in it, and the question is whether or not that lead is needed for product performance. And all of a sudden, we're looking at alternatives in terms of energy efficiency. They have nothing really to do directly with the problem of initial concern, which is the presence of lead.
That's right. And if you can, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying. So, based upon that, your idea about streamlining the alternatives assessment is that much less time and effort would be focused on the issue of energy.
Well, it would be relevant to consider for those alternatives that fix the lead problem.
Right.
You would certainly want to make sure that they aren't going to increase energy consumption by 100-fold. You know?
Right. So again, they inform the focused alternatives are the ones, the alternatives that fix the initial problem.
Yeah,
or they balance.
That's right. Yes.
Jeff?
Yes, Kelly. Kelly,
I think you and Richard are saying different things, and so I wanted to break in because I want to make sure that you all are hearing what I think Richard is saying, what I think I agree with, which is the range of alternatives that would be assessed would be smaller under this proposal rather than the range of issues that would be selected.
That's right.
So, and Jeff, I'm afraid I'm hearing you say, oh, well, let's find something that let's focus first on, say, the health impact, and then we'll worry about the other stuff. And I don't think that's what Richard's saying. I think Richard's saying the first thing. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the confusion came in invoking A to M and saying we're only going to pick one of those for the initial focus of the alternatives assessment, and I'm not saying that. I'm saying you got to this point where you trigger the need for an alternatives assessment because the chemical has been identified of concern, and you then say, okay, what alternatives are available that could fix that problem? Then those are the ones that go forward through the alternatives assessment, and that alternatives assessment would still need to encompass A through M.
Any further comments, Ellen?
I guess my question, this is Bruce again, I guess.
Okay, Bruce.
I guess my problem is with the all-encompassing A through M list, because if you take a look at the, you know, back to the law, safer chemical alternatives and chemicals of concern, I doubt whether anything has ever been was placed will be placed on the list because it uses too much water. It's going to be there because it had some kind of a public health or environmental or aquatic toxicity parameter, and that's why it's on there. So that's, I guess that's probably why we're talking about a tiered approach, because I don't, like, you look at the last things in, like, economic impact, production, product function or performance, those are issues for the manufacturer to resolve when they come up with the alternative, not for the agency.
Yeah, this is Richard, Bruce. I tend to agree with you that if I were writing this statute from scratch, I wouldn't have done it this way. The concern I have is that, you know, the law says thou shalt take into consideration all of these and potentially more, right, A through M. So I think the key to making that manageable is to recognize that the level of analysis that's needed or possible, given data constraints, et cetera, for all of these may be different and may support different levels of analysis or emphasis. And so that's kind of why I was getting earlier at the idea that there would need to be a consideration of each one and a justification for why, provided for why that factor either is or is not significant and a significant differentiator among the alternatives. And only where it was both significant and a significant differentiator would it necessarily go into further focused assessment.
This is Kelly. I'd like to build on that, actually. Jeff, in the handout that Jeff put together that starts out discussion only, and then it has overall character of regulation, and it goes down there. There's a question at the bottom of the first page. It says, all assessments of the above elements meet the design principles equally, and I took design principles to mean that list of assessment criteria. And I think that what Richard's going to, that I agree with, and I actually talked with Mike Kirshner about this after the last call too, is that we both had this reaction that technical performance and cost were largely internal issues for the companies. You know, company isn't going to put forth an alternative that doesn't work, and it's not going to, if something's got too big of a cost or, you know, isn't going to satisfy the customer, the useful life's too short, for example, they're not going to select it either. And so those alternatives inherently seem to have a different weighting and a different level of transparency need. What we were thinking about on that was that the analysis of the human health, environmental, and resource would follow one kind of structure, and that there would perhaps be a different structure for technical performance and cost, which are relatively important only in situations where the manufacturer says those are a reason that there's not a viable alternative for the chemical of concern, or the only alternative available is still one that's fairly harmful. So that's something, and I think that goes right to Bruce's point, which is a good one, which is that these are kind of apples and oranges.
This is Richard. I generally agree with that. I think the one caution I would make is that it may be that there needs to be certainly a requirement that those factors be considered and justified, because I think it's going to rarely be a black and white situation where the alternative that someone's identified simply doesn't work. What's more likely is it'll work 90% as well as the current chemical, let's say, or something that's much more nuanced. It may cost 10% more. So then the question is, and this is a really tricky problem in alternatives assessment, is who decides that 10% more cost is acceptable or not acceptable? Who decides that a 10% reduction in performance is worth it or not worth it in terms of being able to move away from that chemical of concern. You know, so
the market.
Yeah, the market does on some level. That's true. But given so I think all I'm saying is I think those factors do need to be accounted for and part of the analysis, even though I would agree there'll be things that are principally driven by the market.
Any further comments? Okay, let's see. I'd hope that Meg would make it here, but not yet. So it is 10:25 about, and we have spent a fair amount of time with some discussion, presentation. So I think that allows us to probably move on to the questions. But before we do that, again, is there any other comments, clarifying questions, anything that the committee wants to make or discuss? Hearing none, then I think we'll go ahead and move on to question 2A. And let's see, initially, Kelly, I heard some comments that you wanted to reframe certain questions. So does that fall into this category when we start to begin moving through the questions? Do you think that they need to be reframed or rephrased?
It was just in 2A and 2B, I thought we had covered those fairly thoroughly, and the new things we have before us, I mean, maybe you guys don't think we have, in which case we do need to revisit those, but there's really, we now have four options for tiering in front of us: level of robustness of review, number of factors evaluated, number of life cycle assessments evaluated, and the range of alternatives are evaluated. There's four different approaches to tiering, so individually or in combination with each other, and it might be more valuable for you all to get some feedback on each of those four and to make sure that we have time to talk about the other questions. And also, there's some questions on the handout, Jeff, that you prepared that I think Richard started to respond to that a little bit, and I have some thoughts on that too.
Okay, so hearing that sounds like we, if I interpret your response, Kelly, is that you think that we've already done 2A and 2B, and that you would like to talk about the ways of tiering?
Well, I would just put that out there, but obviously the other members might feel differently. So that's, and if the department doesn't feel like it has the responses on 2A and 2B, then we definitely need to talk about them.
Yeah. Oh, Dad.
I think I would agree with you, Kelly. But again, as you point out, if any of the other members present have a different perspective, you know, we definitely need to hear that.
I agree with Kelly. This is Bruce. Could you repeat, you know, when you said we've looked at four ways of tiering, can you either A, repeat those, or B, are they written down somewhere?
Let me repeat them, because I don't think that they're necessarily all written down in one place. The first three that I mentioned at the beginning of our phone call, number one is the robustness of the analysis.
Okay.
Number two is the number of the A to M factors used for the analysis. Number three is the number of life cycle segments that are looked at. And then number four is the one that Richard has talked about quite a bit, which is the range of alternatives that are considered. And Kelly, Richard, Bruce, any of you, if you want to jump in and, you know, add to or tweak anything that I just said, please do so.
Those are the four, I think. I did want to ask folks if there was further reaction to this idea of including among the alternatives this concept of doing without the chemical, if you will. Is the chemical in that application a necessary component? And this came up in the last call, not from me, but from, I thought it was Mike Kirshner, who was getting at this from saying you know, there may be a use of a chemical that is not essential to the function of the product, and you know, I think something like a fragrance in a in a personal care product would be an example of that, where if you compel the analysis to identify alternatives to that that don't include just foregoing the use of that, then you may constrain the ability to deal with that chemical of concern because there's not a substitute for, let's say, a strawberry flavor in your air freshener.
Hey, Richard, this is Kelly. I think that that's something that I think we really ought to be thinking about when we think about what's a reasonable range of alternatives, and that's kind of a different conversation than the department needs from us today. As much as I'd like to talk about it, I know that they want us to talk about these other things so that they can move forward on the thinking there.
Fair enough. I just was raising it because one of the ways of tiering is to think about scoping the range of alternatives. So I just offered in that context, but that's fine. I think we can circle back to that maybe at the meeting in July.
So if I understand this right, and I'm only supposed to be a facilitator, but for some reason I get drawn into this discussion. Richard, it sounds like you're trying to set piece, and this is related to, I guess, SC1 in the infrastructure, that the an alternative analysis or an alternative without the chemical of concern, it sounds like you're advocating that that be an automatic analysis to be required in every alternative analysis. It's a default baseline approach. Is that true?
I think that's right. Yeah, that's what I'm proposing.
Thank you. Any comments on that from the rest of the committee? I actually have a question for staff. Is there anything that prevents, compels that approach statute?
I would say this is calling that the statute is silent as to compulsory elements beyond the A to M, but we certainly have license in a kind of way full and within the scope of the A to M. So I can't see a reason why someone could argue that that's outside the statute, nor can I see an argument that it's compelled by the statute, which gives us the classic position that we find ourselves in with the advice of the committee and the public to help inform whether or not we should approve this year or not.
Okay. Thank you. At the risk of messing up the time schedule that I have one more question of the staff. Richard has proposed that there be some regulatory responses which are not dependent on the outcomes of the AA.
And not strictly dependent.
Not strictly dependent.
Informed by rather than dictated by, was how my phrase.
Right. So I'm trying to, again, I ask the same question. Is there anything that prohibits or compels us?
I would just say preliminarily that I need to examine the statute with this in mind because I've never looked at it from that lens. But there's at least something to further look at, just simply as a matter of logic, that Richard notes that some of the explicit, some of the responses don't seem to tie back to the A to M factors, or at least not exclusively.
Okay.
So it's worth pursuing.
All right. Thank you. Okay, with that, we'll end that part of the discussion.
Jeff, I'm sorry. This is Richard. Can I just elaborate a little bit? Because I think it's not only that some of the regulatory responses don't relate directly to A through M. It's that they are not relevant to whether or not an alternative to the chemical of concern exists. So, and I'm thinking, so, for example, of the requirement for a label or the requirement to impose some restriction on end of life. Those would be regulatory responses that don't depend on whether or not there are viable alternatives, right? So that's my point, is that they can and should be exercised even if a finding were reached that there is no alternative, and
Richard,
they might still
sure
be
I
desired.
Would,
what?
I'm not sure I would draw that same hard and fast conclusion about, for instance, the two examples that you cited on labeling. To me, it seems like an argument for labeling could be the product is important. There is no viable, credible, technically available alternative to the ingredient in the product, but at a minimum, people ought to know to keep it out of the hands of pregnant women or children or what have you. So we probably don't need to get bogged down in which of the regulatory responses tie most closely to the availability of an alternative or not, but your point is well taken that at least we should, you know, for further discussion, keep that in mind.
Okay. I take your point as well, Colleen. That's true. There is some relationship potentially there. They're just not dependent on, in the same way that some of the others are, where you are talking about replacing or restricting the use, et cetera. So, okay, but that, I think you're right. Let's not belabor that.
This is Odette. I just wanted to clarify something. I think we've kind of tentatively agreed to focus our discussion on questions 2A, or I'm sorry, 2C, 2D, and 2E. Of course, when Meg gets on, we'd like to hear her summary of her recommendations. But I wanted to clarify a little bit what I was looking for in posing question 2E, which states, should or how should lower tier AA be linked to the different types of regulatory responses? And, of course, what is meant by lower tier, you know, is significantly affected by what type of tiered approach we end up with. But what I was looking at here is, in your thinking, when you all think about a lower tier, based upon whichever option is your preference, perhaps, is there a particular regulatory, more robust regulatory response that should be attached to that? Now, I'm just going to throw out something as an example for discussion. So, for example, if you go with the approach of looking at a smaller range of alternatives, or you go with an approach of using less robust analysis, should there be a regulatory response attached to that that requires a reevaluation of the alternatives assessment so many years down the road? So I just want to clarify that that's what I was trying to get at with question 2E.
Any comments from the subcommittee?
So did you want to talk about 2E right now?
Well, we can. I was going to proceed and sort of follow your suggestion, Kelly. You talked about robustness, the A to M life cycle, and the range of alternatives to be considered. But I know that if we methodically go through 2AB to all the way to the end, we may only spend 5 seconds on 2E. So with that in mind, if you would like, we can immediately jump in and talk about 2E and then work backwards. Any objections? Everybody's shaking their head here, okay. And I see that everybody on the conference call is shaking their head, okay.
I would suggest, if I could modify your suggestion, Jeff, that they talk about the four alternatives, but just be mindful of what Odette had in mind as she posed 2E, as they give us their thoughts on the pros and cons or interactions of the four alternatives.
All right. So with that, Kelly, the floor is yours.
If we were going to talk about 2E, I was going to comment, but I'll sit back because I think I've talked I'll say one thing about the different tiers. I really think that robustness and of review is important. I feel very uncomfortable, as I think we all did, about factors evaluated, and I similarly would feel uncomfortable about limiting the number of life cycle assessments that were evaluated. But I think the level of robustness of review could be approached several different ways, And one of those ways is by allowing an initial narrower range of alternatives to be considered. And if there's a good one, then the manufacturer would be done. And it's only if there's not a good one that they would be required to broaden that range of alternatives. So those are a few thoughts.
Okay. Anyone else?
This is Ann Wallen. One of the things that occurs to me is, could you not construct something that's much more of a hybrid model? The whole point of tiering is to try and get focused on the things that are going to matter. And so whether it's life cycle segments or robustness of data, you ought to be able to ebb and flow those based on what's going to be most relevant. So for the areas of the life cycle and the particular factors that are going to be most impactful and where the issue really lies, that's where you'd want the more robust information. And maybe for other life cycle segments or other factors, the robustness or how well you cover those is not nearly as critical. It seems to me that we want something that across all of these things that we've been discussing, get us focused on what's going to make a difference.
Thank you. Comments? So I think one thing that Ann has brought up is, at least in my mind, is the definition of robustness and its application. Is it robust in the analysis or robust in the data? Is it qualitative? Is it quantitative? Is it like one of the suggestions before? Is it like a CEQA checklist? So is there any clarity to that? What does robustness mean to the committee that we can then translate into regulatory language?
Jeff, this is Kelly. I've been thinking about this, and again, I go back to Richard brought up something that I'd actually sat and been making notes on myself, which is that it seems to me, and this goes back to the thing that Ken and Ann and I put together, that it's important to have a rationale for an assessment, but it isn't necessary that it be quantitative for everything, that there needs to be some legal standard like substantial evidence or something like that, and that the places that merit the more effort are those with where there's differences among the alternatives or the intensity, severity, and the impact is bigger. And Richard links those two together, and I think that's right to do that. I also think that the third place is where there's uncertainty in an area where there could be a major effect, that's another place where additional effort is warranted, where it is very clear that something is big or small, then the information for decision-making is available. It's where it's unclear that's hard. And that's one of the places where we have to think about how much should be done in the initial assessment and how much might merit focused follow-up work instead. Where do we draw that line? And for me, that line is driven partly by cost and time. So that's what I'm thinking around. I see where Ann is going, and I'm thinking very much along the same way. I think that the first alternatives assessment, the first thing that's done that's actually the alternatives assessment, needs to be a very reasonable thing because it would have such a broad sweep across so many different product types. Whereas follow-up work could be required on specific areas if the answer is not clear, and that should not be applied to everyone equally.
So, yes, I understand the concepts. But what kind of rule sets would you follow in that? Such an iterative approach. And the reason why I ask that is, again, staff here are trying to translate your conceptual approaches, your conceptual observations into regulatory language that would rationally implement those thoughts?
Well, I thought Meg Schwartzman's homework had a pretty good approach in her set of questions. And again, it clearly implies that this approach would be largely qualitative. But if folks have that in front of them, she had four questions under her Tier 1 alternatives assessment that, and she had prefaced it by saying their answers are quantitative where information is available, where data are not available, qualitative responses with a rationale should be given. Answers to the screening questions could include a conclusion that there is insufficient information and explain what the data gap is. So her four questions were, how does the factor A to M, so you would go through A, B, C, et cetera, relate to the reason for designation as a chemical or product of concern? Is there significant variation between the chemical and one or more of the alternatives on the basis of that factor? Where in the life cycle does that impact of that given factor arise? And then is there an alternative that would address that factor? That's kind of an approach she's proposed, which is a little bit of a different approach, but qualitative with justification being required, that kind of approach.
Yeah, I have read Meg's questions, and in the previous meeting, she had discussed the employment of screening questions. And so one of the, if she were here, I was going to ask her, are these the style or the content of the screening questions that she would employ that she talked about last time?
Well, these are the lead-in to those four questions says they are screening questions.
Okay.
Specifically, yeah. So I think this is what she had in mind before. A little bit different than the way she articulated on the call last time, but I think she thought about it a bit more probably, and these are the four she's proposing.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments?
Well, this is Kelly, and I've brought up the CEQA example before, and I still think that's a good model. What's the difference between the particular spot is, you know, what's different between a NEGDEC and an EIR, and how do you proceed there? Yeah, I guess that I keep in my mind thinking that the alternatives assessment looks in terms of level of detail and justification a lot like a NEGDEC, and that the focused follow-up assessment is like a focused EIR. It's coming back and examining an area where there's uncertainty or more analysis is really needed because the decision-making is not clear-cut. But, you know, I'm not an attorney, so what I can give you is an example of a process, but I'm not sure if that really is answering the question that you have, and I feel bad that I'm not able to do that.
Oh, well, Kelly, don't feel bad. We followed up on your suggestion. The other Kelly on this call, Kelly Kirkpatrick, has spent some time talking to our CEQA staff, and we're further exploring the analogy that you brought up for our consideration, and think there's some merit there, but we need to do, you know, a little more homework.
Yeah, I've actually, one thing to know that you might think about when you're exploring that is that I've seen some fairly different, I mean, it's supposed to be one uniform thing, but I've actually seen some fairly different approaches to it among different jurisdictions, because I've worked with a lot of jurisdictions. I used to write EIRs for a living. And so it might be meritorious to actually talk to some different kinds of agencies about how they approach this, if it's something, because it may be that some folks have some bright lines that are more useful than others.
Okay, and we might follow up with you offline, or we might talk to our CEQA staff, because they interact with a lot of other state and local and special district jurisdictions as well.
Oh, I bet they do, because you're responsible agency so much
Correct.
Of the time.
Right. Okay, we can follow up even further, we being the other Kelly.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
All right. So is there any other further comment? I'll call them the Odette factors, robustness, limits on A through M, number of life cycle segments, the range of alternatives to be considered as ways to tier. We had some comment from Kelly about what she liked and didn't like. Do we have any comments from anybody else about those Odette factors?
Got to give a footnote to Richard on number four.
Yes.
On number three, the life cycle segments or stages, I guess I'm not quite sure how that would work. Are we talking about a kind of blanket decision that we're only going to look at certain stages in all assessments, or are we talking about an informed decision that has some analysis that suggests that the big ticket, the most significant issues are concentrated in particular stages of the life cycle, and so we're only going to look at those. If it's the latter, that's kind of consistent with some of the earlier concepts of deciding how significant something is or whether it's a differential across the alternatives. So if the impacts associated with disposal of a product aren't going to differ very much at all depending on which alternative is used, that might be a reason for lopping off that stage of the life cycle from the analysis.
Were you through, Richard? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay. And actually, you know, it is more than just four because, you know, I forgot to when I did the recap, but when I started out earlier, that, you know, it could be a mixture of some of those four, and it could somehow be applied. They could be applied as sort of screening tools. And based upon most of the conversation that I've heard today, that's what I'm hearing your recommendation is that we, in order to get to what Ann says, you know, about focusing on what's most important, what's most relevant, and really you all have said that, you know, we consider all of those, you know, in particular, which life cycle segments are most important, which of the A to M factors are most important, and use that then to go on to the next level of evaluation. So I hope that answers your question. I don't think that it's necessarily valuable to look at each of those four in isolation. And I haven't heard any of you necessarily recommending that we look at any of those four in isolation.
Right. I don't think Ann had made a comment that there's an iterative analysis that goes through.
So it would be probably in most cases a qualitative or semi-quantitative judgment that says these factors and these life cycle stages are likely to be the most significant or the most differentiating among the alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the approach I would agree with. I think what's most important is to have a requirement that there be a full justification so that those choices are made as transparently as possible and with an understanding of on what information or expert judgment they were based.
All right. So, any other comments? It is now 10 minutes on our clock to 10 to 11, and looks like we are trying to, again, discuss question 2C, 2D, and 2E. Kelly made a comment about uncertainty, and I look at 2C and it says what data or other information should be required to obtain or be developed and evaluate to support each AA tier. And Kelly's brought up the issue of uncertainty analysis. So I'd like to open the floor for a discussion around question 2C and what to do with uncertainty or the lack of data. Again, the subpart question to that is what kind of data is going to be needed to support whatever level of alternative analysis seems to be reasonable. With that, I appreciate your comments. Everybody's tired.
Everybody's waiting for somebody else to go first, aren't we?
Well, the folks here are telling me let's have a break.
Well, and we can do a break, but if any of you have comments you want to make on this question, let's, you know, while it's fresh in your mind, go ahead and have the discussion.
Yeah, this is what I've been struggling with because, on the one hand, you want your alternative assessment to be as complete and thought out as possible. On the other hand, you don't want your alternative assessment to take 5 years to do and cost $1 million. So, the you know, one approach is to say rely on an existing data for the initial alternatives assessment, and if the data gaps go towards areas where the information could cause potentially significant effects and it's an alternative that's desirable for other reasons, then you'd move, you'd have a decision point and say, do we want to do a focused follow-up assessment or, you know, how should we proceed? I mean, that's one approach. But I keep coming down to the idea that there needs to be a standard that's more descriptive, like substantial evidence in the record or something like that, because some things, the information's right there, it's available, you can grab it, or there's enough information to show that the alternatives are similar, the impact levels are similar, that this factor is not going to be an important factor in the decision-making. Whereas other places, there's a big data gap, say it's chemical Y, and we know nothing about its human health impacts, and it's a potential alternative that's valuable for a lot of other reasons. There, my thought would be that, well, perhaps if the manufacturer really is interested in pursuing that, then they should put in a plan for a focused follow-up assessment to get that data and say, do we think this is safe for humans and therefore makes a good alternative? So I'm not sure that was clear, but you can hear that I'm kind of struggling around this issue. So I'd be very interested to see what other folks are thinking here.
And we are struggling with it as well. That's the question.
Right. Any other comments? I mean, Kelly, in terms of having uncertainty about information, it's sort of like what kind of effort or resources need to be placed, or what kind of requirement do we need to place out there to reduce that uncertainty, and how big of a requirement? That's a challenge.
Exactly. You understand why I'm struggling there. And I have actually Procter & Gamble might be helpful to us because they have a decision-making process that they use to decide whether to do additional investigation on a particular endpoint on a chemical they might use in a product. And I found it very interesting how they did that and how they would either discard something or say, wow, this is really potentially useful and we've got this gap, let's go spend the money on the additional investigation. So that their decision-making process might be helpful to think about this.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Okay, I think what we'll do is we'll take a break early. It's now 5 minutes till 11 on our clock, and I think we'll reconvene in 10 minutes at 5 minutes after 11.
Thank you. Nikki, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
How many members of the public are listening to the conference right now?
Okay, one moment, please.
We're back from the break. Let's see who else is back. Nikki, are we back in the conference?
Yeah, Ann Wallen is here.
Okay, good. Thanks, Ann.
Oh, Richard Dennison's here.
Thank you, Richard.
Kelly Moran is here.
Thanks, Kelly.
Is the operator?
So, Bruce, are we still waiting for Bruce Court?
Yeah, we're still waiting for Bruce. And is the operator back on?
Yes.
Okay.
Kelly, are you maybe getting the feeling that Meg is not going to be able to join us today?
Yeah, she hasn't appeared. I don't know what happened. So
okay. Actually, she sent me an email saying she would not be able to make it. I guess she's at a doctor's office with her aunt.
Yeah, it's a family matter.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, so are we ready to begin? We have a sense here that folks feel that, or actually have no additional input related to question 2C, 2D, and 2E specifically. And if that's true, I'll make that assumption, and if there's an objection to that or you have things that you want to add, please speak up. The one thing that we thought we'd do, if that is true, is that we might go through the flow chart, because Kelly did talk about wanting to discuss some of the questions that we laid out that was designed to stimulate our thinking. And then, Odette, you had a suggestion to continue the discussion in general, right?
Anything else any of you want to recommend to us relative to this topic?
Right. And so I guess that's that way we're not – we don't necessarily have to go all the way to 12 o'clock if you feel that you've provided as much input as you can. So with that, does anybody have any comment on that?
This is Kelly. Just briefly on 2E, I don't think the department should structure the regulation such that it precludes a regulatory response without a certain precursor. At this point, maybe after the department has some experience with the AA process, it might say, well, we're never going to make this kind of decision without it. But at this point, I'd be reluctant to recommend that you do that.
Could you clarify? Colleen, can you clarify what you mean by a necessary precursor?
Well, just say the department could write the regulations so that certain regulatory responses wouldn't be available until a certain level of assessment was done or something like that. And I guess I'd be reluctant to have the department do that at this point because I don't know exactly how you would structure it, but it also – you could wind up tying your hands and requiring some manufacturer to incur some substantial unnecessary expense. And so that's why I heard Odette kind of asking that question, are there certain things we'd want to do before we did certain regulatory responses? And my answer to that is I wouldn't link those in the regulation at this point.
Yeah, this is Richard. I think I have the same concern, and it's keeping in the spirit of sort of my view of this, that the alternatives assessment informs, if I'm reading the question right, informs the regulatory response, but doesn't necessarily dictate it, that there may be situations where the regulatory response would entail, let's say, a restriction on the use of a chemical of concern, even if there are not alternatives available, because the concern is so high, or because of some other factor. So the part of the question I'm not sure I get is, how should lower-tier AAs be linked? I guess the point I'm making is, should or how should the AA, whatever level it's conducted at, be linked, the different regulatory responses, and I don't I see only pitfalls from saying, well, you know, if the AA shows this, then we can do that, but we can't do this. I think that's probably hard to judge in the abstract up front and needs to be probably more of a case-by-case decision depending on a lot of factors that would be in addition to the AA as input into that decision.
I was thinking more along the lines of whether or not you would recommend that if the AA involved, again, a less robust analysis, maybe because data was not currently available or it looked at a fairly limited set of alternatives based upon the criteria you guys have all talked about, whether or not you would recommend that one, doesn't have to be the sole regulatory response, but that one regulatory response should be that they should have to reevaluate the alternatives assessment at some point down the road. The idea being that at some point down the road there might be more alternatives available and or there might be more data available.
I see. Well, I certainly would think that would make sense in many cases. It's more the, I guess I'm not sure I see a need for or an advantage to, in an upfront manner, saying, in that case, we will always do X.
Okay.
You know, we will always require more information. It might be that the nature of that assessment is such that it would tell you that there's not really much to be gained by having it redone later. You know, I'm just speculating, but...
Okay.
Right. Any further comments? So again, question 2C, 2D, and 2E. The comments that we just heard or discussion that we just had about 2E, that sounds like we just reframed that question. And Kelly, you brought up the issue of reframing questions. Did you have any further comment along that line?
No, but thank you.
Okay. So it sounds like everybody has really pretty much said their piece so far and don't want to have any further discussion on 2C, 2D, and 2E. Does that sound correct? Any objections? There has been a suggestion to move on to the few of the questions that are on the graphic. Kelly brought that up. Does anybody want to continue discussion related to those questions? All right.
Well, this is Kelly. I'd be happy to talk about the two on the back.
All right.
On the second page of the two-page handout that you created, Jeff, you asked questions about the impacts assessment rule sets. When I looked at the graphic that showed the life cycle impact assessment, one thing that I didn't see there that I actually think might be important to consider is development of conceptual models. And I know this seems kind of an odd thing for a regulation and a life cycle assessment, but one of the things that I've learned from this process is that, or from my professional experience, is that a lot of manufacturers don't really understand the steps after they make their product, kind of what happens to it and where it goes. And I learned a lot from working with folks by drawing conceptual models, very, very simple conceptual models, not fancy things, you know, the kind of stuff you can draw by hand, and just think through the various places that the product goes and where emissions can occur and where exposures can occur. And I just would want to put out there for further consideration by other folks and the department whether the tools that they create might include a question that would ask the manufacturer to draw up a simple conceptual model for at least three different pieces of the life cycle, the before the product becomes a product, so basically the resources to manufacturing stage, the use stage, and the end-of-life stage, the post-consumer stage. And the reason for that is to make sure that do everything we can to help the person doing the life cycle assessment identify the issue categories that need to be examined in each of those phases. So that's one just thought I'm putting out there for you all to ponder. The other one, and then in that I've kind of implied my answer to the other one where you say, do we want to do an impact assessment for all elements or all portions of the life cycle below? And there's a very complicated life cycle graphic there. And I would here again suggest perhaps simplifying this into three general categories, basically before the consumer, while the consumer is using it, and after the consumer. But I'd be very interested in the reaction to others to that kind of simplification. So those are my inputs.
Thank you, Kelly. Comments?
Does manufacturer, is manufacturing captured by the first stage, the raw materials upstream? It's not yet a product stage.
That was my intent, was trying to say, is there some way to simplify that into three pieces, before the consumer, during the consumer, and after the consumer? So before the consumer would include everything from the raw materials through the manufacturing.
Okay.
And maybe that's too simplified. I don't know. I was just trying to say, we tend to, life cycle assessment, people tend to get into these very complicated graphics, and it becomes daunting and really impossible to think about 12 different factors times all of these different phases. And so I think we're going to have to think about how to simplify that in a way that makes sense. And so that's why I was just putting something out there for folks to react to. And this may or may not even be the right group. You may really rather be talking with that, with the alternatives assessment group about that.
So do we have any comments related to Kelly's input?
Kelly, where's the simplify? I'm looking at the chart, and I see the complex one. Did you say there's a simplified version?
No, there's not. That's why.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I got you. I thought you had a simple chart that somebody like me could read it.
I like that simple chart. So if somebody wants to create it, that'd be awesome.
Okay.
All right.
I guess, Kelly, I like your proposal of some simplified life cycle stages, and I think, again, as you talk about tiering, you then could decide whether that's enough to make the decision that you need to make. And if it's not, you think maybe, I don't know, it's really in the occupational exposure, and you're going to have to do more on that first stage, then that's some of this prioritization and screening that I guess I'm kind of looking for in this process to get us, again, focused on the few things that are really going to matter.
Okay. Any other comments?
I think, this is Bruce again. I think it's important that we do figure out a way to simplify, because if you take a look at, and because in every one of these, as I see it, you're going to have to make a comparison. You're going to have some kind of analysis of the current chemical of concern to make a comparison to, is alternative A better in this category, worse in this category? And if I look at a company like ours, we would have, I mean, we have a good handle on total water usage, total energy, total emissions, all of that kind of stuff for each individual owned site of the company, office buildings, and including manufacturing plants. But what we don't have is, say, let's say we make 2,500 different products. We don't have the individual contributions of those today. I'm not, maybe on the top, it's a 90-10. I mean, we probably have that on the top 20 products, but we certainly don't have it on all 2,500.
Mm-hmm.
And to actually parse that out or figure that out is even, you know, even for one product is a significant task. Because you can't just relate it to pounds. Everything is different. You know, you just can't say, well, I made so many tons or pounds of that, so we'll just divide that by the total. That's not how they're gonna vary.
So again, I hear Bruce arguing that it's going to take an individual product process, and there will not be a one-size-fits-all approach. I have a question in terms of earlier Richard talked about focused alternatives assessments, focusing on the problem at hand, the chemical of concern. And Kelly, you're talking about an alternative approach to what we've laid out, which is, again, just a discussion piece that asks for the development of conceptual model and production used in post-consumer. But if we're focused on a chemical of concern, what use would a production conceptual model have in terms of informing resolution of a problem related to a chemical of concern? So why would we care about mining of raw materials and the like in the production phase when we're simply focused on trying to produce a safer product by not having that chemical hazard present?
I think what you've asked is the reason that the statute requires us. The statute requires us to care about that.
Well, one reason why it might be relevant is, you know, gets at the subcommittee I was on in the first round of this whole issue of de minimis, et cetera. One of the issues comes up that certain chemicals are present because they're byproducts or they're co-contaminants of a mined raw material. And so knowing that and knowing that there are alternatives perhaps that don't have that chemical of concern because of the way they're processed or mined in the first place might be quite relevant.
Excellent. Any other further comments? Questions? Do you all feel that you have thought as much as you can, provide as much input as you can here at this meeting for all of the questions? Or any other clarifying comments, discussion you'd like to do?
Jeff, what do you guys need? I'm not sure that we've advised you on the things you really need. So I guess I'd really appreciate it if Odette could tell us or your team can tell us, well, here's a question we're still hanging on, or here's one where we'd like to hear your advice, or have you say, no, I think we've got our advice on this topic at this point.
I actually think you've covered most of this pretty well. I think, though, you know, when we sit down and we try to make this specific in terms of regulations, that at that point other questions may arise that are more specific, and we may well want to come back with you, you know, the graph as a whole, probably, or through asking members to provide written comments. Not sure how we'll do it, but to get some further details as we get more specific with the actual regulatory language. One thing I will tell you, that this is a question that is on one of the graphics. It was actually the one that was prepared for topic one, and this is something I'm not asking you guys to comment on today. Certainly you can if you want to, but this is really something I think that needs some forethought, and we're going to send it out to the graph as a whole to include with the July meeting, and that is recommendations on how to deal with trade-offs in terms of impact. So that's something you might be thinking about.
All right, thank you. Any further comments? All right, hearing none, it sounds like we might be able to call the meeting to a close. We did receive your written input, and if you have any more thoughts, you have input on the questions that were originally posed, we would appreciate your written input so we can enter that into the record. And again, remember that the staff is trying to develop precise regulatory language, and if there are thoughts and concepts that you want portrayed in that regulatory language, clarity would be most helpful. We already have lots of questions, and we have lots of conceptual and generalized ideas placed. But again, they're trying to translate all of that into precise regulatory language so that your ideas presented in the most precise form is going to be most helpful to the staff. So we are asking for this information. I will allow you to write up to 3 pages, and the staff are all rolling their eyes, but I will 3 pages because Kelly, yes, Kelly, she's already turned some, Richard has, and of course Meg has, and the other folks probably have things on the way. If you have any additional thoughts, maybe that extra page or so will give you more space. Thing is, we asked for it to be sent and provided to the department by June 20th. Please make sure that Radhika, Kathy, and Odette receive that by email so that we can then sort of synthesize it, place the things back out on the website, and have it prepared for discussion for the July.
And Kelly, this is Odette. I know that you submitted, you know, the document, which we've made numerous references to last year. I think you've expressed some additional ideas on this topic, so I would appreciate it if you went back and looked at that and gave some thought to, is there some additional recommendations you want to provide to us?
All right. Maybe you and I can talk offline because I'm not exactly sure what you would want. I'm a little...
Okay. It's, you know, I'll just tell you briefly, and then we can talk separately. But as I looked at the document the three of you prepared last year, you're focusing mostly in on sort of the robustness model and following, you know, the CEQA approach. But there's some other things we've, you know, I think there's some other ideas we've talked about today and that you've offered some opinions on that I'm not sure embodied there. On the other hand, if after you go back and look at that, you feel that that does fully embody all of your thoughts on this topic, then that's fine as well.
And would it be more useful to you for me to modify the flowchart or the text or both?
Probably at least the text, but you may find you want to do both.
Yeah, the text, it's harder because it's just kind of exemplary. The flowchart, it seems we're still kind of up at the flowchart level of how would the process work.
Okay. Do that then.
Okay. I will work on that. I may need to give you a call to better understand what I should do, but I appreciate knowing that there's something I could do that would be useful to you.
All right.
Okay. So, once again, we would appreciate your comments focusing on things that you would want to see included in the regulation. And always, if there are things that you don't want to see in the regulation, we'd be happy to read about that also. So, again, June 20th, make sure the agency has it so we can, collect it, assemble it, post it back up, and send it out to your colleagues. So with that, is there any last comments? All right, hearing none, then I want to thank you all for your participation and your hard work. The agency really, really appreciates it. And we look forward to your participation in July at the face-to-face meeting. I thank the rest of the Green Ribbon Science Panel members who may be on the line, and I thank the public who also has spent time to listen to our deliberations. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.